March 30th, 2016. You are looking live at Athens, Georgia. This is episode 558 of the Willie's Experience podcast on sports on Earth. I am Will Leach, and I thank you for spending part of your day with me. Two podcasts this week. Excited to have on, I apologize to this guest in advance. It's been a somewhat busy couple of weeks. I've rescheduled him a couple of times, so I'm glad to finally have him on. Long overdue. His name is Sean Fury. He's the author of the book Rise and Fire, The Origin, Science, and Evolution of the Jump Shot and How It Transformed Basketball Forever. Also, I think you can hear one of my children in the background. They're not in the room, but it's not that big of a house, and you can hear them downstairs, probably wailing for their lunch. But we're not here to talk about that right now. We're here to talk about Sean Fury's book, Rise and Fire, which is a very good book. I enjoyed it very much. I even got to blurb it. I'm glad to report that the top two blurbs on this book are from Mike Krzyzewski and me. Yes, as a matter of fact, his blurb is first. Here is my blurb, if you want to hear it. This is a book about a shot, but it's, of course, so much more than that. One basic shot, a fundamental human movement, is interpreted and evolved around the country and the world, with everyone adding their own regional take. Fury's book is thorough and smart, but more than anything, it's a lively, extremely fun travelogue through a journey that parallels that of the sport it transformed. There. You should still read the book, but first, you should listen to my podcast with Sean Fury. All right, first off, thank you, Mr. Fury. As you know, as I just read my blurb in the intro to your to this podcast, so everybody knows how I feel about the book. Though one of the nice things about reading something that I've written on a podcast rather than just talking is it usually is more eloquent because as I'm better in print than I am in a podcast. So everybody that listens to this knows that. So, sir, congratulations on the book. Is it going well? Are you having fun? Are you freaking out? This is not your first book, but, you know, certainly – you know, I always worry whenever people have a book that first comes out, they always go a little nuts. Do you have the experience of going nuts in the past and therefore it's easier?
This one's a little different because it's with a bigger publisher, New York City publisher, much more press on it. So it's been much, much more nerve-wracking. I think like a couple of weeks ago, the publicist at the publisher emailed and said the Washington Post was reviewing the book that weekend, but he had no other information other than that. So I spent a few days very, very nervous, but it was a good review. So yeah, it's definitely nerve wracking, as you know, but when you read a good review, it makes it all seem worthwhile. If you hear from readers, especially, that's, I got an email from like a 95-year-old guy who played in the 30s and 40s. And remember some of these players I write about. So that's what makes it really fun when it finally comes out.
So you do kind of track the history of the jump shot and how it's kind of ebbed and flowed. And I'm curious, one thing I wanted to ask you fervently, because obviously the jump shot's always been a major part of the game. But it is funny how it does seem, even in my lifetime, even the last 20 years, it has become, there have been times where it's been vogue and the jump shot has been popular. And then it seems like it's abated a little bit. And now it feels like the jump shot has become really popular, except from a farther distance. Do you, you chronicle that a little bit in the book, but can you talk a little bit about the idea of that kind of ebb and flow, how the shot has evolved, but more specifically how there are times that, while it's obviously always been a part of the game, there's a time where it feels like coaches have emphasized it and de-emphasized it, and now it seems to be coming back.
Yeah, even going back to the 30s, the first guys who started shooting it, and at that time it was coaches who were very against it, and a lot of them outright told the guys, don't shoot that shot anymore or you'll be benched. And some of them did get benched, but they kept shooting. They're setting these scoring records for, obviously, back in the day, not what you'd see today, but they were using the jump shot to score a lot of points for that era. So they stuck with it, and eventually the coaches kind of came around. But then you even get into the late 50s when the jump shots finally become – you're seeing it everywhere in pros, college, high school. And that's when you really started seeing the media start speaking out against it in some very big publications. I mentioned Jimmy Breslin, who very famous New York City newspaper guy. But back in the day, he was just a young sports writer, and he wrote a piece saying that the jump shot was ruining basketball because it – increased scoring, it made the individual, gave him much more power. You no longer had to pass it 8 or 9 times to find an open shot. So it was really interesting just seeing how the media backlash to the shot. And once it finally in the 60s, obviously, it'd be ridiculous for anyone to be still claiming it was wrecking basketball. But then it did kind of, like the 70s I write about in the book, you had these guys like Pete Maravich, Austin Carr, Bob McAdoo in the NBA, who really, for the first time, used the jump shot to put up these outrageous scoring numbers, and they were shooting 40, 45 times in some cases. And that's just an era that we never see again. And it's something, it's kind of like Buddy Hield, maybe I wish he would shoot like 40 times. But so it's really interesting how in that era the jump shot really ruled. But then I think it took until the three-pointer has the last, like I said, 5, 10 years even, it's become even much more than it was 20 years ago. And now it's really taken completely over the game at all levels, obviously, especially in the NBA, but any high school, college game you watch too, they're just launching three after three.
One thing that I think you get across really well in the book is, well, it's pretty. Like it's like the thing about the jump shot is it is aesthetically pleasing. It's just a lovely thing to watch. And it's funny how as the shot has regained prominence, and it's funny to think that this was thought as an individual move, because if now, of course, the jump shot is considered, you know, now it's a combination of what Breslin was railing against, the idea that we're losing all these passes, plus the beauty of the jump shot to find the ideal, both the ideal. The game has increased its efficiency and its beauty, I suppose, at the same time. But do you know, is it? It's funny to think that that has come full circle in a lot of ways. But it always starts with someone hating it. You know? It always starts with someone like fighting against that. Do you feel like the jump shot is at its peak now? Like having watched it throughout history, what obviously done the research for the book and read about it throughout history. Do you feel like this is? Like in form, it's even better than it's ever been. Do you think they've maximized the efficiency of the form?
I definitely, the form, that's a very interesting point because a couple of the guys I talked to, whether it was a player like Austin Carr, who started, he was in the NBA when the three-pointer just came into the league, and he talked about how his form, it was great from 20 feet, but he just didn't have the form to shoot from 23 feet. And a couple of shooting coaches I spoke with, you know, you think about some of the guys in the 80s, like Jamal Wilkes, his bizarre shot, but even Bernard King, Alex English, these great mid-range guys. But their awkward forms, which were fun to watch in their own way, they wouldn't really be able to hit three pointers in today's game with that kind of style. So I think this generation now of players that have basically, they've always had the three since it came into college in 87 season. So kids have grown up with it now for 20 years. So I think the form definitely has changed to where now it's kind of, there's not like a universal form, but I don't think you see as many quirky forms that you did see in the 70s and especially in the 80s, where it didn't really matter how you got the shot off because you were shooting from shorter distances. And now you really do need good form. There's obvious exceptions, the Sean Marions, but it is much more important, I think, to have that kind of ideal form to shoot from the three-pointer, which has become the dominant shot.
Well, it's funny too because you know, I you saw the generation of players that grew up watching Jordan and all wanted to be Jordan. And then it's funny, listen, because the player that LeBron is, I don't know if there are a lot of people that grew up wanting to be LeBron. I think a lot of people that grew up loving LeBron and admiring LeBron, but I don't think there are a lot of people that, I mean, it's just, it's hard to be a floor general shooting baskets in your backyard by yourself. But to me, what Curry now, he seems to have connected with kids the way that Jordan connected, but through a shot, which makes me wonder what this is going to look like in 20 years when all these guys that are watching Curry now and watching Buddy Hield doing basically as close as we have in college basketball to that, and watching all these other people that can shoot, and not just in the United States but around the world, you wonder how this is going to make, how it's going to change the game even more in the next 20 years.
Yeah, I was just thinking about that last week with Curry, obviously, especially this year, he's kind of become famous for these shots from 30, 35 feet. And will in 20 years, will that be considered almost a routine shot if you have this whole generation of players who are going to be practicing those shots? I don't think there's any doubt that, you know, something coaches always lament. You go into a gym and you watch kids just launching it, but I think that's a shot that's going to become more standard. So another generation, what we're seeing from Curry now, which is so awe-inspiring and we've never seen it before, could be a very common shot. And it's very interesting to think about because it just shows also how a single rule can change the evolution of the game, how players shoot, how they look, you know, how they play. And that's obviously the 3-point line. And if you go back to widening the lane with the dominant centers and the 3-point line, the way it's just changed the game, and I don't think it would ever be eliminated, I think it's just you're going to continue to see players eventually who are shooting like Curry, even though I think it's safe to say it's still doubtful we'll ever see another one like him.
It is funny though, because like you're already seeing, it's funny you mentioned that Breslin column, you know, you've seen a few of these this year, like, oh, Curry's ruining the game. What? Why is he? Like, it's funny how, like, there's always going to be that old crank that
Yeah.
tells you the game right now is wrong, and in 30 years. But it is funny to think that the idea, I hadn't even considered that notion, that the idea of a what the game looks like if all of a sudden there's a whole generation of people that are used to shooting 30-foot jumpers.
Yeah, would and you know, sometimes I feel like an old crank too, because as much as I love the jump shot, obviously, sometimes, and I Free Darko, Bethlehem Scholes wrote about this the other day, that the 3-pointer has drastically affected. He wrote about the NBA, but it's not like the Warriors are to blame. I mean, they're great at it. It's these other teams and other players that aren't so good at it, but yet still shoot it at the same rates as Golden State does that. Sometimes I watch them, I'm like, oh God, it's like too many 3-pointers for any team not named Golden State. So it's just, but you don't see that changing at all, because obviously analytics has played a huge role in that, and the math isn't going to change. So I just think, you know, 5, 10 years, our team's going to be shooting 53-pointers regularly. And would the NBA ever really do anything about it? Because I wrote about in the book, Zach Lowe a few years ago wrote that David Stern mentioned that the NBA was monitoring how many more 3-pointers teams were taking. But I haven't heard anything about that since, even though they just keep increasing.
That would seem a really bad time for Silver to come out and be like, okay, we're going to go slow down on the 3-pointers as everyone is having this incredible wave of what the Warriors are doing and enjoying it. I'm curious too, you touched on this a little bit in the book, but the idea of, I'm curious your thoughts in a macro sense of the international flavor of the game. You know, the idea that how the shot may have changed a little bit because of international of the way the game spread around the world. The idea that, you know, I remember when Dirk Nowitzki showed up and they're like, "What, that guy's 7 foot? He can't have the best jump shot in the game."
Yeah.
And he did. Can you talk about that a little bit? Just the notion of how the world of basketball and the jump shot was changed by the kind of the international presence.
Yeah, and I think two guys in particular really stand out. I actually wanted to write a lot more about them than I had the chance to in the book, but Oscar Schmidt and Drazen Petrovic. Schmidt, of course, an international star. Petrovic, very good NBA career. But they were kind of in that mold. I think the early international players, if they were good shooters, they kind of had that reputation as being their only shooters. And Schmidt especially was a huge gunner. You know, he would score 50 points a game and just be launching threes. But I remember when he lit up the 1987 U.S. team in the Pan Am games, he had a shot that was obviously unmatched on the international level at that time. And there were certainly NBA guys who could have matched him, but just his gunner's mentality that he brought, you really didn't see in the American game at that time. That was something more that you might have seen in the late 60s at the college level. So players like him and Petrovic, they really, I think their games, they inspired people in their homes. I think that was a big part. You know, they became these absolute icons in their home countries, which inspired that next generation of players, which we're now seeing today. And obviously someone like Dirk, this revolutionary player who came from Germany, that wasn't something I think I can remember when he first came to the league, he did seem like a joke. It seemed like a Don Nelson, you know, big reach and a joke. And then he became probably the best big man shooter ever. So it is interesting to see how the jump shot has, you know, it certainly changed the game at each level, the NBA, the college, and high school. But it does take this regional flavor in the country, but then also the international guys really add their own mix to it each time one of them becomes a star.
It's funny to think, I'm assuming, you know, you've seen Chantel Osahor, the basketball player, the women's basketball player for
Yes.
Washington, and
Yeah.
she and is that really what the game looks? She has she, just to give context to people who don't know, she is they're in the Final Four, I believe, and she has just this amazing set shot. Is that what it looked like all the time before the jump shot? Was that the like? I mean, people would usually wouldn't shoot that far, but you know, is I mean, it's hard to imagine. To me, I'm curious in your research for the book, because now that you see the jump shot. You know, it is one of those things that, like, wait, what did this game look like before this shot was not here? How did people not immediately embrace this? It's obviously such a major part of the game. And it's really hard to even visualize it until you see someone. It's like someone shooting free throws underhand. It's
Yeah.
just this amazing thing. And she's really good at it. It's a really cool thing to watch, but it's insane. It's impossible to imagine that obviously it was that way, but it's impossible to imagine that the game ever actually looked like that.
Yeah, and the thing to me was always, why wouldn't the first players ever have just jumped when you know, yeah. James Naismith's first game. What it's right. like such a common sense thing, but it took 40, 50 years. And yeah, that was, you know, if you see some of those very, very old clips where they're just passing it around, obviously with the set shot, you needed to be much more open. The defender, you know, he had to have some space to be able to launch that thing. But it was fun reading the old newspaper accounts. They would say that they could shoot those from much farther distance than the jump shooters of the day. Obviously today with, you know, the Currys, you can shoot a jump shot further, but you read these accounts of set shooters and they would say they were shooting from 40 feet away. And it's impossible to know if those are just exaggerations of the newspapers of the day, but it did seem like a shot where they could add extra distance to it because they were kind of, you know, shoving it, pushing it out there. So I think you did see a lot of long distance shooting, but you just didn't see the creativity that the jump shot brought when it finally came into the game.
One of the things I love about the jump shot too, and you know, every non-athlete who wanted to be an athlete has the myth of the idea that like, oh, if only I would have had, if I'd know, I'd have been 6'6", or if I'd have been able to run faster, so I could have, become, you know, I still think at the age of 40, I could make it as a backup catcher somewhere in Major League Baseball. I'm fairly certain of it. If someone would just give me a chance, John Mozeliak, I am here. Brian Peña, you don't need him. But the thing about a jump shot, the thing I love about the jump shot is obviously you need physical abilities, you need to be athletic to be able to do it. But it is something that, you know, it's harder to improve how high you can jump. It's harder to improve how much you can dunk. But the jump shot, to me, you know, the thing that all jump shooters have in common, some are short, some are tall, some are mid-sized, some are whatever, they're all gym rats. They all are. It doesn't seem like there are a lot of jump shooters that just like woke up one day with a natural ability. It is something that requires repetition and practice and the drudgery of long, long work.
Yeah, and that's kind of goes to the, I think Chris Ballard had a story a couple of weeks ago with on Curry and the nature versus nurture argument, where someone, you know, obviously you have to put in all the work, but Curry and me shooting 10,000 hours of jump shots isn't going to turn me into Steph Curry. But he also had, and it's impossible, you know, to quantify how much that helped him. He did have a dad who was a great shooter, a dad who was an NBA player. So he grew up in that environment as well. With him, it's this unique combination of all that gym rat plus being born into this basketball family. But other players, yeah, there was a guy in the book who said that he thinks all great shooters are introverts, which, you know, is probably a generalization, but just that idea that they can disappear in themselves and they can be content shooting 500 shots every day, shooting for 4 or 5 hours every day. And that's definitely something, you know, the guys I would research, whether they were the names that we all know or kind of some of the more unknown players, they all talked about that. I even talked to, you know, the first woman drafted in the NBA, and she lived in this tiny town and she would go out and shoot at her small park for 8 hours a day, just honing that shot. And so it's definitely something. I mean, I still go out and play in my old man's league. I just love, you know, shooting for an hour and somehow thinking I'm still getting better. But yeah, it's definitely a skill that you can't just walk on the court and have it. And I think you see really good players who don't have a jump shot, and you kind of can see it there where maybe they haven't quite worked on that skill enough.
When you have a whole chapter, as one would suspect, devoted to Larry Bird, and it's funny, you wrestle with something I find interesting, the notion of a pure shooter in the idea of that book. Because usually when you hear pure shooter, it's often like, oh, like Steve Kerr was a pure shooter. He's a pure shooter, but he couldn't really do anything else and so on. But what's funny, which is maybe not necessarily fair to Steve Kerr, but you know what I mean? The idea that like someone just shoots, they're a pure shooter, but then that, therefore they must have all these other deficiencies in their game. Kyle Korver often gets that a lot too.
Yeah.
But Bird was almost such a great player outside of his jump shot that you could almost get lost that he might have been one of the greatest shooters of all time.
Yeah, and that's what I write about. And it was something I kind of wrestled with in that chapter. What did separate him from so many of those 80s players, him and Magic, was their all-around game. It was the rebounding, the team game, the team defense, scoring down low, the passing, obviously, all that. But it really was the shooting that set up so much of that. When you talk about just his passing skills, if a defender fears that jump shot, it opens up a lot more for him. it allows him, he wasn't the quickest guy, but if a guy's up close on him because they're worried about his great jump shot, it gives him the chance to drive around him. So it was really fun reading, and there were some magazine profiles, newspaper profiles of the day that said how everything involving the Celtics, you know, that great front court, their great team play, it all started with the Larry Bird jump shot. And if that was ever just slightly off, which it rarely was, but occasionally, that it threw everything into disarray. So I think you're exactly right that the fact that he is one of the three or four best all-around players ever can obscure the fact that he was an amazing shooter, and also the jump shot set up so much of that all-around game.
I want to ask you, I want to just kind of, I don't really have a question so much as I want to just have you talk about, I'm going to do a whole sports writer thing and say, talk about Kitty Sailors. He's considered in a lot of ways, you talk about in the book, as the one of the fathers of the modern jump shot. What's his story? Kind of tell me a little bit about how he kind of helped usher the shot in or even popularize it a little bit.
Yeah, Kenny, and unfortunately he just passed away a couple of months ago. He had been in good health for 94 plus years, and then the last couple of months of his life had some health issues, and he passed away in January. But he is one of those first guys that I talked about in the 30s. He took his first jump shot in 1934 as a 13-year-old, I believe he was, on his family farm in Wyoming, playing against his bigger brother. And his was kind of, he did realize, oh, if I jump, it helps me, because he was going against his older, taller brother. As brothers would do, he would reject his younger brother's shot over and over. And Kenny finally one day dribbled up to him, jumped, and shot. And from that day forward, he worked on that shot. And he eventually became a star at the University of Wyoming, led them to the national championship. And then also a few days later defeated the NIT champ, who was kind of considered a bigger deal back then. So they were really the best team in the country. And it was his jump shot, and it was his one-handed jump shot that really set him apart. Because so many of the early guys, they would shoot the jump shot, but they used it with two hands. They would twist in midair. They held the ball above their heads. Where he had a form, and there's some great pictures of him from back in the day, where he really looks more like what we consider a modern player. And obviously, as we talked about, forms are always changing, but his shot would look pretty at home in today's game. And he had, you know, the guide hand on the side of the ball. His elbow was perfectly straight. And then he jumped. They said he had a vertical of 36 inches, so he could really launch himself. And then he eventually goes into the war, comes back, and then 1946, Life magazine takes a picture of him shooting a one-handed jump shot, and it really establishes his fame. It's very influential. People see that and are like, oh my gosh, that's a new way of shooting. And then he had a decent NBA career, nothing spectacular, played a few years, which was very common for back in the day. And then he kind of got lost to history because he went off to Alaska, worked there as a coach, worked as a tour guide. And it wasn't until the early 90s when people kind of revisited his career and realized, oh, yeah, he had this shot that was not only way ahead of his time, but would have fit in today, in today's time. And so the last 10 years or so, he got a lot of publicity for the fact that, you know, it's impossible to name who the first jump shooter was, and I write about that. Mm-hmm. You can't name one person, but he's definitely someone who deserves credit for being, as like you said, the father of the modern jump shot. It's kind of the nickname he's been bestowed with. And it's a credit to him that he did have that early impact, where even he was ahead of his time as a jump shooter, but even in that group of, you know, 10 or 12 guys who were shooting jump shots, he was even ahead of those, because the way he shot, no one had ever seen. And I was really happy that he was able to, eventually in the later years of his life, really receive that credit that he deserved.
And then I guess my last question for you, I want to know your personal opinion. You've watched so many jump shots. You've seen so many jump shots. You've written about so many jump shots. What is your, do you have one that you love the most? The one that if you could bronze that one, the one that inspires you the most, this beauty of this shot, do you have a favorite one?
I might be kind of weird. Chris Mullin was always a favorite. I think it was partly that left-handed thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Like a left-handed hitter in baseball, just their swing looks prettier. And I just always loved his jump shot as a lefty. And as a kid, I would try impersonating his a lot, but it didn't really, I don't know if it was the righty-lefty thing. It never really worked, where he kind of seemed to push it out a little bit from holding it at his ear. So he was one that I just loved watching him shoot. Again, another very good all-around player, but that jump shot is really what drove his game. And then someone who I did write about in the book, whose shot was just so easy-looking, Dennis Scott, especially his Georgia Tech days. I just loved him at Georgia Tech with Kenny Anderson, Brian Oliver, and I would go out to the neighbors and try shooting like he did his All-American junior season. And obviously in the pros, he just had this at 6'8". He made it look so easy, and that kind of just compact, pure shot was one that I always enjoyed watching.
Yeah, my 4-year-old son is left-handed, and he nice. Has such a prettier shot than I do. It's very frustrating. He can barely lift the ball, and he still has a prettier shot than me. It's funny.
No, they do.
It's a weird kind of thing. I've never quite understood why left-handers can do cooler stuff than we are, but they can. They look cool doing it. All right, Sean, the book is fantastic. The book is Rise and Fire, The Origin, Science, and Evolution of the Jump Shot and How It Transformed Basketball Forever. It's a terrific book, and I'm excited to have you. I'm sorry about the delay, but I'm elated to have you on finally, and I'm hopefully everyone should go ahead and buy the book. It's really good.
Thanks a lot for having me, Will.
Of course. Be safe. All right, everyone. We'll be back on Monday. Seriously, go buy the book. The book is really – I'm actually holding the book in my left hand, showing it to my microphone. I don't know why I'm doing that exactly. But if I could, I would be doing my Dick Cavett right now. I'd be showing the book to all of you right now because it's a good book. It's Rise and Fire. Anyway, so we'll be back on Monday with previewing – we'll have a baseball game to talk about with Allison Futter. So everyone have a wonderful weekend. Enjoy. I'll be in Houston for the Final Four watching lots of jump shots, hopefully. So – all right, everyone have a wonderful weekend, and I'll talk to you all on Monday. Be safe.